Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to today's program, which is part of our ongoing effort to provide critical insight into the private sector issues that are shaping our world, which are very exciting at the moment, as I'm sure many of us are aware. My name is Jennifer Cobb, and I'm the Vice President of Business Development here at the Council. And we're very honored to have with us here today Simon Johnson, who's the Ronald A. Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And Simon will be in conversation with Richard Lyons, who's the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. We thank you both for being here today. Before we begin, I'd like to just say a quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and informs action. To learn more about the Council, you can always visit our website, itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, you can always listen to our weekly radio broadcast, It's Your World, on Monday evenings at KQED. And on our website, you'll find an audio and video archive of all of our past programs. Today's program is being recorded for radio, and we'd like to thank our audio engineer, David Ogilvy. Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices that might interrupt our program. While you're doing that, I'd like also to point out two upcoming programs that might be of interest. On Wednesday, June 9th, the Council is welcoming Stephen Roach, Chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia. This luncheon event will be held at the City Club in San Francisco at 11:30. Then on Tuesday, June 15th, join distinguished economists Barry Eichengreen from UC Berkeley and the senior director from the Asian Development Bank for a discussion on economic integration across Asia. This event will be held here in the Council Auditorium at noon. Finally, you will see that there are blue question cards that were placed on each of your chairs. Please write your questions and hand them to staff members who will be located throughout the room. It's now my deep pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guests. Richard Lyons is the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Prior to becoming Dean in July of 2008, Rich served as the Chief Learning Officer at Goldman Sachs in New York, a position he held since 2006. As Chief Learning Officer, Dr. Lyons was responsible for leadership development among the firm's managing directors. Prior to coming to Haas, Professor Lyons spent 6 years on the faculty at Columbia Business School and taught international finance. Simon Johnson is the co-author with James Kwok of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown, a major new assessment of the U.S. financial sector. Dr. Johnson is the Ronald A. Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. He is also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., a co-founder of BaselineScenario.com, a widely cited blog on the global economy, and a member of the Congressional Budget Office's panel of economic advisors. He is also a former chief economist at the IMF. And tonight, he will be featured on the PBS NewsHour, for those of you who'd like to tune in. Here to discuss financial regulatory reform and share with us ideas on what needs to be done to avoid future financial crises, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Simon Johnson and Richard Lyons.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you to the World Affairs Council. It's a very topical question, set of questions that we're addressing today. Thanks to Simon, friend and colleague, for being here as well. I think there are a lot of things we all agree on. I think we would all agree that the system failed us. I think we would all agree that reform is coming. I'm not sure that we all agree that that reform will be enough or the right reform, but I think that's sort of where most of us probably are. So I'm going to begin there with a fairly basic question when thinking about what's coming and what needs to come. Simon, you have shown us and told us and explained to us why you believe the fundamental causes of the issues are still with us. So if you could just give us a quick rundown of why they're still with us.
Right, absolutely, Rich, and thanks very much for this opportunity. The basic part of the problem that we focus on is the power structure within the financial system. And it's our contention that prior to September 2008, some of the biggest banks became insufficiently cautious because they were big, because they're powerful, because they were able to persuade Congress, actually, over very long periods of time to deregulate in ways that favored them. But the key point, the answer to your question, is that look at what happened since September 2008. Look at what happened to those big banks. It's true that Lehman Brothers left us, and there were some other absorptions. But for the most part, that same power structure remains. In fact, the biggest banks got bigger relative to GDP. If you look at their assets, so the size of the banks relative to GDP, they were 15 years ago, the big six banks and the banks, their predecessor banks, were around 17% of GDP. Prior to 2008, they were 58% of GDP. Now they're 63%. Pushing 65% of GDP. So they keep getting bigger, and this is the result, obviously, of some policy decisions that were made. Under duress, we can argue about whether they were good or bad decisions, but those decisions have been made. And now, you mentioned financial reform. I live in Washington. I work on these issues on a daily basis. The power and the force with which these big banks fight against reform is absolutely mind-boggling.
Yes. Thank you. Let me... if we why do banks get so big, right? So if we a simplistic question would be, is it mostly through acquisition or organic growth, or is that just not an important issue here?
Well, I think that's an important issue. I think understanding the history of our financial sector is very important. That's why we wrote the book. And of course, acquisitions have been an important part of the growth of some of the banks, Bank of America, for example. Other banks, such as Goldman Sachs, have done very well through more organic growth and more overseas expansion. Globalization, which does have its benefits, but it also has its side effects, some of which, you know, have been clear for a while, and this one I think is a much more recent manifestation. So both kinds of growth of what we've seen in the past, and I think going forward we should expect to see both again. Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, said to his shoulders recently, if we're big it's because we're good, and if we get bigger that's the outcome of a normal market process. Well, I with respect to Mr. Dimon, I disagree. I think they have a big subsidy because they're too big to fail. They borrow more cheaply than can other competitor banks that are smaller. As a result, they have a taxpayer subsidy, an unfair, non-transparent, and actually dangerous taxpayer subsidy that will enable them to get bigger until they have a major problem.
So I'm clear, the borrowing more cheaply is this idea that there's an implicit insurance policy that other banks don't have, and that's effectively lowering their borrowing costs.
Absolutely. And I say to my many, I have many Republican friends, okay, not quite as many as when I started this process, but I still have many, and I say to them that with regard to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac before 2008, my Republican friends were right, because they emphasized that Fannie and Freddie had an implicit government guarantee, lowered their cost of borrowing, enabled them to bulk up and become, because they were seen as being too big to fail. And that turned out to be correct, because when there was pressure on them, Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson, who certainly didn't start out being a particularly pro-bailout person, maybe he changed his mind under the pressure, but he took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and made them into essentially government obligations.
Yes.
Now, our point and the point of the book is that if you just change the names, take away Fannie and Freddie, put JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup, the big six, you have exactly the same sort of incentives that Fannie and Freddie had. And it's a tough problem, because left to itself, the market will allow them to become bigger.
Okay.
Because the government is expected to ride to their rescue when needed.
Okay, and so as we get concrete about policy, and you think about, or we think about, what's the right size or the maximum size, and over time, how do we define that and build policy around that that's robust, resilient? Help us think about what the right size looks like.
Well, that's a great question. That's, I mean, as researchers, you and I are going to spend a long time looking at that, and we'll have hopefully encourage our colleagues to look at it. There is no well-established, generally accepted optimal or ideal scale for big banks. What we do know, though, is this, that the economies of scale and scope in banking are more or less exhausted by the time you reach $20 or $30 billion in total assets. So let's call it $100 billion. Let's round up to the benefit of the banks. So at $100 billion, the social benefits, if you like, flatten out. The private benefits obviously continue to increase. If you run a bigger bank, you're more likely to get to have dinner with the president. You probably noticed that you didn't get invited to the White House that often. Mr. Dimon is there quite frequently. The big banks, like J.P. Morgan Chase and Citi, became $2 trillion, $2.5 trillion, in the case of Citi, before the crisis. So that's mostly private benefits above the $100 billion number that I was highlighting. And the costs, I'm afraid, are quite evident. The costs that we incurred since September 2008 because a bank like Citi essentially failed. 8 million jobs lost. A 40% increase in our debt-to-GDP ratio, all the fiscal measures the government had to take to prevent a second Great Depression. Our inability now to really effectively reform the system because these big banks have got so much power.
And so I'm clear on the numbers. The 20 to 30 or the 100 billion rounding up, is that's an asset number? We want to think about that as assets?
That is a balance sheet asset number. Obviously, in today's world, and most of those studies are based on historical data, before derivatives became so important. So a very interesting question would be, what is the mapping between your derivative positions and that size? And of course, what we learned with long-term capital management was a bank that had about $4 billion in capital. This was in 1998, if you remember, they failed. They had $4 billion in capital. They leveraged that up in ways that were not completely transparent to their counterparties, to $130 billion. That was a bank that, at that time, was big enough, people felt, because of the nature of its positions, to jeopardize the system. Mm-hmm. And so my numbers are rough. My numbers are, this is a heuristic that we've developed. And I think we need to look at this much more carefully. It could be, you know, at the end of the day, we feel that banks bigger than $50 billion are too big from a social point of view. And in addition, I would emphasize, we're not saying that reducing the size of largest banks is, we never said it's sufficient for financial stability. We just said it's necessary in this political context. We would also support all the restrictions on the table for making derivatives more transparent and exchange traded, and for putting other restrictions on the kinds of risks that banks can take.
Nice. Help me understand the if a bank, whatever the level, if policy were to change in that direction and a bank were bumping up against it, what would they do, should they do, in order to, because they obviously have to continue conducting business, to prevent crossing a line?
I think that's a relatively easy one, actually, because you would be required, I mean, if the rule really were effective, if we suddenly found we had regulators who had some spine, which is a leap, I admit. We haven't seen them in a while. There is a restriction on the books. There is under the Regal-Neal Act of 1994, no bank is allowed to have more than 10% of total retail deposits. But when banks have bumped up against that limit in the past, they were waved through some combination of loopholes and regulators feeling that it was an okay thing to do. So any rule that I propose has to have some regulators willing to implement it. But if you were approaching the cap, I think you would be required to split the business up, to find some logical way to divide the business. Mm-hmm. And this is where the point about economies of scale and scope matter. If it were the case that you could only run a bank, it only made sense to run a bank at a $1 trillion scale. It just, if you broke it up, made it smaller, the whole thing would collapse. That would be one thing. But no one can show you that evidence. There's no. There are claims that have been made by leading financial sector executives, but despite repeated invitations, I mean, not just by me, but by congressional committees, to explain the evidence and lay it out for them, nobody's come up with such specifics. So you'll be required to split. And you know, most of our evidence, Rich, as you know, in these situations where insiders have become very powerful and they control these mega corporations, most of the evidence is that if you force them to split up in this way, it's actually good for shareholders. Not so good for the insiders necessarily, but there's no reason that we can see why shareholders wouldn't benefit from a system that was run along these lines.
Mm-hmm. And you know, most of these people are very much internationalists. If we thought, and you've thought a lot about this, right? So would it need to be a global solution, or could it be a U.S.-only policy initiative?
Well, obviously, you should try and address these issues on a global basis, no question about that. And we do have the G20, and there is a role for American leadership there, and I would suggest, and we do propose, the U.S. take the lead there. But I wouldn't wait for other countries. I think this is, you know, because we're such a large economy, because of our position relative to innovation and technological dynamism around the world, we can take the lead on this. And I would also say, I would emphasize you shouldn't expect other countries to take the lead. I mean, if you look at the, some people say, and some senators said on the floor of the Senate last week when this issue was being debated, that there are big banks in other countries, and therefore we can't make our banks smaller because that will put us at a competitive disadvantage. Well, my question to every senator and to all of you is, name the big banks around the world that you would regard as admirable models of governance and performance. I mean, I think we can rule out the Chinese banks that are very big because they are effectively backed by the state and they're full of problems. We know that, and the Chinese actually readily admit that. I think you can rule out the Japanese banks because you know the mess they got themselves into, and they still have many remnants of the problems of the 1980s, actually. And now I think you can rule out the European banks. I mean, the European banks, seriously, with their incredible overexposure to not just to Greece but also to Portugal, also the links between Portugal and Spain, also the way that Spain has been able to borrow, all of these banks have got themselves, and we can argue about to what extent they got sucked in the European context by a broader policy delusion, but nevertheless, they were all present at the scene of the crime, and they were all essentially bailed out by the measures that the Eurozone adopted with US and IMF assistance over the weekend. So it's very hard to find mega banks around the world that are paragons of virtue or something you want your banks to grow up to be like. I actually say, and I truly believe, that if we made our banks smaller, they would run rings around bloated, stupid, state-backed banks in the rest of the world. Hmm. Right? That is the American way. Hmm.
Let me ask you this question. If we thought, let's think about the political economy of what's going on. Are there any arguments that you're hearing from the other side, i.e., don't do this, that you find at all compelling?
No. But let me tell you what I think their strongest, what they view as their strongest arguments, which is, so one argument is the global competition one, which I already hopefully debunked. The other one is that if you made the biggest banks smaller, you would actually make the system more dangerous. And there are very serious people in Washington and around the country who argue that, and I have no reason to question that their sincerity. And I think, you know, theoretically, you could probably construct a model in which you have more little banks and the little banks or smaller banks and the smaller banks are harder to control or they are more prone to failure and those failures sort of amplify and blow up when they come together. It's a bit of a stretch, though, to be honest. And on top of that, I would put the political arguments. I mean, the access, you have to see it to believe it, perhaps, but the access that the biggest banks have, I mean, I single out Jamie Dimon only because he's very, very good at his job. And I think JP Morgan Chase was one of the banks that was least damaged by the mortgage problems and that probably could have seen its way through the crisis actually without any capital or other support from the government, arguably. Jamie Dimon says in public very clearly that political lobbying is an important part of his job. And you can see his hands, for example, less explicitly, but around the attempts to put derivatives onto exchanges. So there's a large amount of derivative trading that's over the counter. It's very opaque. And the administration itself is increasingly worried about this. But JP Morgan Chase, by most accounts, has a 40% market share. And they are very, very effective lobbyists. And this political power of these mega banks, I think, is something you would not get. Gary Gensler, who's the head of the CFTC, which is the regulator responsible for a large part of derivatives, says, and he's a former Goldman guy, he really knows the business, he says that if we had all derivatives traded on exchanges, that would undermine the power of the big broker-dealers like JP Morgan Chase. So, of course, they're going to fight against it. So, to me, this on the systemic risk issue, the bigger banks are more dangerous. A bank like Citigroup has failed 3 times in the last 30 years, each time with big systemic implications. And that's not going to go away.
And so, I'm trying to get the political economy straight. Is it a very traditional way of thinking about a vested interest and a resource behind it? Well, let me put a hypothesis on the table. It may not be correct. part of this may have to do with the fact that these are complex issues, that the public, the person on the street really doesn't, most people don't get what a credit default swap is, don't really understand how vast and multifaceted the derivatives market is. And so that when one tries to influence the reasoned opinion of smart people, there's a little bit more room to do that. Is that a helpful element of this, or is that really not so helpful?
The complexity is definitely an important part of our problems. So there's complexity, of course, within the firm. So one reason that people were able to take on so much risk, apparently without the understanding of their top executives. Mm. I remember that Chuck Prince, the former CEO of Citi, and Robert Rubin, former Secretary of the Treasury, former key board member of Citi, both said they had no clue what was going on in terms of the amount of risk that Citigroup was taking. Mm. It's pretty bad news for Citigroup shareholders, honestly. But that's about the complexity in modern banking. And that complexity also now hurts us in the debate, because what you have is a lot of claims and counterclaims that even smart, well-informed people who try to stay up with the issues have trouble deciphering or figuring out who's on which side. Partly, to be honest, I blame the White House. I think the power of the president to simplify, clarify, and really force people to understand these things has not been well used. But I think we should recognize these are complex issues, and there's a hiding behind a smokescreen that the complexity makes possible that's really going on.
Glass-Steagall is one way of thinking about a smaller dimension to this, a kind of Glass-Steagall 2.0. Why doesn't your thinking naturally go to the solution we've seen before?
Well, I think that the spirit of Glass-Steagall was, of course, the law in the 1930s that tried to separate what was then called, and what makes sense to call, commercial banking, dealing with ordinary businesses and retail customers, with investment banking that was about raising capital and also trading in markets. I think the spirit of Glass-Steagall is still very relevant. The spirit of Glass-Steagall, as I would interpret it, is that you have part of the financial system that's going to be backed by the government. We're going to have deposit insurance. Nobody's going to take that away. And you should try to wall off the financial institutions that benefit from having this basically cheap source of capital, cheap source of funding, separate them off from highly risky activities through restrictions on, for example, what they can do. Now, the problem, the reason we don't emphasize so much going back to Glass-Steagall is the world has changed a great deal. And, for example, mortgages used to be regarded as one of the safest, most simple, plain vanilla products that commercial banks could do. That was obviously the absolute heart of where the system went wrong in the past decade. We have to recognize that. But I think the attempts or pushing towards restoring a firewall between risk-taking parts of the financial system, which I support. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship, among other things, at MIT. I like people who take risk. I like people who back entrepreneurs who take risk. But I don't want that to be done by the banks that are supported by, that have insured deposits, or that are otherwise in the part of the system that needs and is honestly going to benefit from various forms of government protection as you go forward. I'd like to find some way to separate that out. It's a tough one. What we emphasize as a complement to attempts to refine that firewall is making them, all these banks, smaller. So they can fail. Particularly, you can fire management and have unsecured creditors take losses when these banks fail, while also continuing to protect insured retail depositors.
And the argument that what part of what we saw, I hope we agree, was regulatory failure, enforcement or otherwise. I think people agree on that. The notion that some of these strong policies might also suffer from significant regulatory failure. Do you worry about implementation shortfall of some of these strong policies?
Absolutely. I think that's a critical weakness in our system. And again, a reason we wrote the book is to try and highlight that and to try and get more discussion and change what you might call the intellectual environment around regulation. The most telling graph that I saw recently, actually I didn't see it in time to put it in the book, but it's a fantastic graph from Tom Ferguson and Rob Johnson, which shows the wages of the regulated and the wages of the regulators over the past 30 years. And as you can imagine, the regulated do this with their wages, and the regulated wages are pretty much flat in real terms. That's a huge part of the problem. Thomas Philippon and Ariel Reshef have a very good paper that shows relative wages in the financial sector relative compared to other parts of the private sector.
Yes.
That shows that finance was a highly paid job in the 1930s on average. It wasn't that highly paid in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and even a little bit into the 80s. But as deregulation took hold, these jobs became very well compensated. And this pulled a lot more talent in to the financial sector. It also gave them a lot more intellectual firepower. We have to put resources, both financial and I would say intellectual resources, in the hands of the regulators in order for them to have any chance at all to stand up to the bankers in the political arena, broadly defined.
Do you think a bank size policy will happen? I mean, you mentioned the vote last week, but.
So there was a vote last week. This was on an amendment to the main financial reform bill currently before the Senate. The amendment was called the Brown-Kaufman Amendment. And it failed. It got 33 votes, and it was opposed by 61 senators. And you can interpret that in one of two ways. First of all, it failed, so it's not going to be in this legislation. And the most we can hope for is a much, much weaker version that was in the House bill. But on the other hand, 33 senators did step up and support an idea that even 3 months ago had very, very few adherents. And I would give a lot of credit here to Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware, who really took the lead and brought a lot of people with him. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio also played a very important role. And I would say ideas are changing. They are quite in flux. And I think that eventually we will get to, as part of a broader set of reforms, 5 or 10 years down the road, I do think we'll have a hard size cap on banks. We have one already, by the way, in the Regal-Neal Act. It's just that's out of date. It was for retail deposits, not for where all the action has been in the last 15 years, which has been in wholesale financing. So it's not a complete break with our traditions, even our recent 20-year traditions. And as we argue in the book, it's absolutely consistent in our interpretation with the history of measures taken to constrain concentrated economic and financial power in American history.
Let's talk a little bit about the... suppose we don't, over the next X years, 3, 4, 5 years, have a bank size policy. What's the next policy proposal you would have us follow? What's the next most important thing we need to do?
Well, as you know, it's hard to pick just one. I mean, it's all about complementarities. It's all about having a package. But the one piece that I would stress that is not sufficiently on the agenda is with regard to capital requirements. So the capital for a bank is the amount that you have to hold as a cushion against losses. And this will increase as a result of international negotiations. So the Basel process, which some of you probably know a lot about, will, I'm reliably told, lead us to capital requirements for what's called Tier 1 capital, which is the most... the cleanest definition and the one that makes sense to focus on, we'll get a capital requirement between 10 and 12% of total assets. Now, that happens to be almost exactly what Lehman Brothers had the day before it failed. So that's where we're going to go with the reform process, back to what wasn't sufficient for the failure of Lehman. And I think that if you talk to technocrats, talk to people who work on banking in Europe, for example, which I do, there is strong interest in pushing that further.
Yes.
To 20% or 25%.
Yes.
None of them can tell you how we get there politically. I can't tell you how we get there politically either. We used to run our bank system in the United States before 1913, before there was a Federal Reserve, with a much higher level of capital. It wasn't a perfect system. It certainly had failures from time to time. There certainly were instabilities. But I don't think we're trying to get to an economy with no instabilities, and an economy with no imperfections would be a crazy dream. So I think moving ourselves back towards a financial system with a lot more capital, and another way to think about this is more equity, a bigger part of the financing for banking coming from equity rather than from debt.
Yes, yes.
Right? So it's not the case that a bank is wiped out by 1% or 2% losses, which is the case for some of these very high leveraged banks before September 2008.
Great. I'm going to turn to your questions in just one moment, but one self-interested question. You're at a business school. I'm at a business school. Well, how should we be training our graduates differently?
That's a great question. Well, you're actually responsible for making that decision.
Yeah, so, that's correct.
I should ask you. Look, I think we should... at least what I do in my classes, which are about macroeconomics and international economics and global strategy and entrepreneurship around the world. I try to tell them what I think is going on and why, and we use my blog, Baseline Scenario, as a teaching tool, which so they can see the debate and they can see that it, you know, there are people with different, perhaps opposing views, and they can get engaged in that dialogue. I mean, honestly, we should also do a better job on ethics, I think. We should modernize and update the ways we teach ethics. It needs to become something more real to these people. And we should also, I think, teach them that there's costs as well as benefits to modern finance.
Good. Thanks. Turning to the questions, this one is on orderly resolutions, bankruptcy. Can a big bank in trouble be restructured smoothly in the middle of a financial crisis, or is a bailout the best option at that time?
So this is obviously a great question and a huge question. The essence of the government's, the Obama administration's proposal with regard to big banks, and this is supported by the big banks, which might make you a little suspicious, but bear with me. The essence of their proposal is that the government will have a resolution authority which will enable it to take over and shut down, but in a managed way, any big bank or other financial institution when it gets into trouble. Now, there are two problems with this. One, which is mentioned in the question, which is in a crisis when things are bad, are you really willing to pull the trigger on a big bank, or do you sort of take it over and run it in what's called a conservatorship, which, while you might be intending to wind it down, is exactly the status of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG. Those are very expensive propositions. They become government-run financial institutions, and everywhere this happens around the world, with a very few exceptions, those are bottomless pits for taxpayer subsidies. So you have to look at this very hard and say, will we really to pull the trigger on a Citigroup or a JP Morgan Chase if it's a $2 trillion bank or a $4 trillion bank? Or, by the way, you want to talk about bank size? Let's talk about the Royal Bank of Scotland. The Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS, when it failed in 2008, was 1.5 times the size of the UK economy. That's the balance sheet relative to GDP. So put that in Citigroup when it failed. I'm sorry, ran out of liquidity. I always get that confused. In 2008, was about a $2.5 trillion bank, if you include all their off-balance sheet liabilities. If it had been RBS scale relative to the U.S. economy, it would have been $20 trillion, right? And that's just far too scary to deal with. And that's why I want to make them smaller, make it more likely that we can have them fail in a managed way. The other problem with the resolution authority is it's not global. It doesn't deal with cross-border issues. A bank like Citi operates in over 100 countries, and I've heard Goldman people brag about doing business in 90 dialects. So if you don't have a cross-border authority, you can go talk to the people in charge of bank resolution in other countries. They'll tell you that our resolution authority won't change or remove the chaotic nature of a failure of one of our big institutions in terms of the global markets.
Thank you. On that global, I just want to follow up on that. I don't think this is a major point, but if we compare a balance sheet of a bank to U.S. GDP, that may have been a reasonable denominator 20 years ago. It's much less reasonable today, right? I mean, we have to think about most of these banks are really quite global in their size. Now, even if we put global, so the question then is, how big is your balance sheet relative to global GDP today, whereas it might have been a reasonable comparison to ask relative to U.S. GDP 30, 40 years ago?
That's true, Rich, but you have to also ask, who has the ultimate fiscal authority? Who steps in to back a bank? And as you know, Switzerland, for example, which has got two very large banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, they had total assets about 8 times GDP when the crisis hit. The Swiss are very worried about this. Now, you could go to a system where you would compartmentalize different parts of, say, UBS. So the UBS in Spain would be, you look at the size of that relative to the Spanish economy and see how comfortable you felt with that. If you build big global banks in a small country, another word for you is Iceland, right? Which had banks to GDP between bank assets between 11 and 13 times GDP. When they failed, it wasn't all an Icelandic responsibility, but it was so much an Icelandic responsibility that the country crashed, and it's an enormous mess going forward.
Good point. As a regulatory matter. Question from the group. Do you think without the bailout, a depression would have occurred?
So I think there was a risk in September and October of 2008 of a second Great Depression. I think most people who look at this agree this was the worst financial crisis since World War II. Most people who study the Great Depression agree that the financial crisis of 1929 to 1931 was a huge, and the global nature of that crisis in the end of the 20s was a huge part of why we got a Great Depression. So I do think that the system had to be saved in fall of 2008. I have more arguments, actually. I have arguments a little bit with how they did it, and we talk about that in the book, but much more of my arguments are with the Obama administration in early 2009, because then the system was not at a moment of imminent collapse. There was an opportunity to be much tougher on the bankers who had managed their way into this mess. And senior administration officials will tell you, even today with a straight face, that if they had ruffled a single feather on the back of even one Citigroup director, this would have caused a worse crisis and deepened the recession. I find that implausible, frankly. So there were other paths available, other tools available that would not have, in our view, stored up quite so many problems for the future. The Obama administration could have followed that.
Thank you. Thank you. Another question from the audience. You mentioned social utility of the banks. How do you define social utility as far as banks are concerned, and how would we measure it?
So this was talking, I was talking about the economies of scale and scope in banking. And one way to think about this is go back a long way in our history to when banks actually, in many states, were only allowed to have one branch. You know, you could require that again. You could say that that's necessary. And particularly, if you could also say no ATM machines if you really didn't like the ATM fees. I mean, you can get very, very restrictive on banks. Banking is an activity that is completely dependent on what you allow it to do from a regulatory standpoint. But that, I think, we'd agree, doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of your access to your money, also in terms of the diversity of the bank's portfolio. To the extent they're holding anything other than government securities, you would like them to be able to lend to people who are not all tied to exactly the same local economy. Because if the price of gold collapses in a gold mine town, or if the price of software collapses close to San Francisco, this would affect those local banks. So there is, I think, a sensible concept of economies of scale and scope in banking. What is it from a social point of view? What size we want banks to have? But the fact of the matter is that all the evidence, and I can think of 19 studies on one side and one unpublished working paper on the other side, that say that the current scale of our banks in this country is far in excess of where these social benefits flatten out. And so you don't get benefits to increasing size beyond that level.
And when the banks, just in their narratives, argue that you're missing economies and efficiencies, where do they go with those arguments?
They go to some of my colleagues and hire them to do research projects for them to establish that. And those papers, those papers will have to evaluate when they come out.
What are the underlying mechanisms there, though?
It's very vague, to be honest, Rich. I mean, we have tried to have this discussion, preferably in public, preferably with cameras on, but also in private. And I have not got a very clear answer to that. Not an answer that you could actually, you know, write down and show to a graduate student and say, you know, does this make sense, or prove this, or turn it into, you know, something you could actually measure? It's very vague and fuzzy. It's about spillovers in relationships. It's about how everybody loves to do business with global banks, a single bank. It's interesting, actually. So we do talk to CFOs in the non-financial sector, and we do talk to CEOs in the non-financial sector, and what they tell us is quite. I mean, this is just anecdotes, but these are the anecdotes of the customers, if you like. And these are the people who Jamie Dimon, for example, JP Morgan Chase, claims need him to be a global bank. When you go talk to his customers, they say that's not true. They say that they'd rather work with different banks in different places because banks are good at different things in different places, and they don't want to be dependent on one guy for all their financing. They want to play their suppliers off against each other, which is a pretty sensible business principle. And they also point out that when they, you know, if you look at a big company like United Technologies, and the CEO of United Technologies endorsed our book, George David, when they do a bond issue, it's underwritten by a lot of banks already. So it's a question of how many more banks do you need in the syndicate to handle a big bond issue, and of course those banks are, to a large degree, distributors. But you want them to be able to hold some of the securities while they're distributing it. So it's not clear to me from talking to leading people in the non-financial sector that the banks' own rather informal arguments actually hold any water at all.
Okay. Canada's experience. Can you give us some insight into the Canadian experience. Large banks seem to have largely avoided the problems of the U.S. and many other countries. Any insights there? Any lessons?
Yes, I have a lot to say about Canada. One of our colleagues, Randall Mork with the University of Alberta, likes to joke that if you ever want people not to read your paper, put the word Canada in the title. I have to say, my experience has been quite the contrary. One of our most successful blog posts recently, and this was also in the New York Times Online, where we have a weekly column, was called "Canadian Banking Myths." And this got a lot of attention, actually a lot of favorable attention from Canadians, not entirely favorable attention from Canadians. But basically the point is that the Canadians have five big banks, and these banks are well regulated. So there is not the same degree of regulatory capture in Canada as there has been in the United States. And we can speculate on why that is. Presumably it's about the very different nature of Canadian politics. We can admire the Canadians for having that, but assuming that we can move ourselves to be more Canadian seems to me to be quite a stretch. In addition, I would point out that there is a very large degree of government guarantee on mortgages, particularly risky mortgages, have to be insured with the government. Mm-hmm. Now, if you put that into the U.S. context of a government basically cheap insurance on risky mortgages and the relationship that we have between our regulators and our private banks, I think you'd agree that would be a recipe for disaster, yeah. So the Canadian experience is admirable and to be looked at from a safe distance.
Great. Thank you. I want to jump back to derivatives trading, and this is a question. All big banks seem to want to trade derivatives, but in these trades, doesn't somebody always lose? So how can they all make money at trading derivatives? What edge do they have? Should they have that edge? Thoughts on sort of most people are not calling for putting an end to derivatives markets, so there's clear social value there. But this intense interest for the banks, clearly there's income coming. Can you help us understand? Do they have unfair advantages? Are they mostly market makers, or are they mostly trading on their own account against other people with more information? Do you have any views on that?
Well, I wish we knew is one answer. Seriously, the data that we have on derivative exposure, on derivative trading, is very weak. And this has become clear, or is again made clear, by what happened last Thursday when the stock market fell dramatically and then in an unexplained fashion and then rebounded very quickly. We don't know to what extent that was the so-called large traders, and we don't know to what extent it was derivative trading, but it probably was some combination, along with other factors that were affecting the markets around the world. So my view of this in general is very, very similar to that of Gary Gensler, who I mentioned before, who's a very experienced derivatives trader, and a very good person, by the way, to have at the CFTC. And that is that while you have these markets that are over the counter, that are not transparent and where people don't see exactly what other market participants are doing, that gives a big advantage to the large so-called broker dealers like JP Morgan Chase. If derivatives were traded over exchanges, then you would have less concentration of economic and political power in those markets. You would have less concern about the sort of misrepresentation that various banks are now accused of having undertaken with regard to some of the derivatives based on mortgage products. And I think you could also still worry, by the way, about problems building up that you can't see, because these are very complex compared to ordinary or plain vanilla financial transactions. But I think that I for one, I'm not calling for derivatives to be by any means abolished. But I think running them in a much more tightly regulated way, requiring people to hold a lot more capital against derivative exposures, by the way, because at least in part people are gaming the capital requirements by taking derivative positions. I think all of these things make sense, and almost none of them are going to happen, by the way.
And just a quick follow-on here, because you as an economist understand that there are economic contexts in which more transparency is not better, right? They may be isolated instances, but I think the intuition for most people is that transparency is always good. There are certain transactions that don't happen when you make them transparent, and in fact, people are better off if they happen. But I'm not suggesting that transparency is necessarily bad, but there is a lot of economics around situations in which you have to think twice about increasing transparency if you want the right social outcomes. But again, that's part of this debate, right?
Absolutely, and I think the point is to have the debate. And I think that's what we've been missing in this country for quite a long time, is that people assume that because there was a financial innovation, because a product was introduced by some really very smart people making a lot of money coming out of Wall Street, that this thing was necessarily good. And I think instead we should get much more into this. Okay, what are the costs? What are the benefits here? And let's think of it from a social point of view, as well as from the private point of view of the people involved. And you may be right. Maybe we will find places where we think there's a limit to transparency, for example, around derivatives. But I think on the whole, the people I talk to and the people who are very closely engaged in these markets would like there to be more transparency. I actually had a conversation with one person earlier this week, who I can't name for obvious reasons, who said to me, you know, that he and his organization have been pushing really hard for derivatives to all to be exchange traded. He said, but given that's not going to happen, we're just now aiming to be too big to fail.
U.S. rating agencies, help us understand, right? What was, you know, there obviously there's a role here. Are we making any progress there? I mean, what more should we do?
Well, we're not making any progress. What should we do? That's a great question. And the system of whereby people are rating securities and being paid by the issuers of those securities clearly doesn't work. The conflict of interest is, I think, quite apparent at this point. And I think we need to switch to a different revenue model. I think there are also very valid questions that people raise about the. And this is an issue of, you know, having some regulation and not very good regulation or insufficient regulation. When you have a certain investors who are required to hold securities that are investment grade, then who decides something's investment grade? And what happens when they decide something's no longer investment grade? Those are very valid questions. I don't have an easy answer to them. I think changing the revenue model of the rating agencies makes lots of sense. I think reducing the size of the biggest players makes sense because they're obviously the ones who were most easily able to overpower intellectually and really make the rating agencies do their bidding. But it is a tough question, that one. Actually, it's one of the harder questions.
It is. Thank you. Here's just about trying to be more explicit about if we're going to break up the banks or make them smaller, specifically, how do we do that? And I think your proposal is more or less to let them decide that there's a threshold. We'll let private decision makers decide, but right?
Absolutely. So with the Brown-Kaufman amendment would have introduced a cap in 3 to 4 years, and would have put the onus on management of the banks to decide how to best to split up their banks. They have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to make the most of this opportunity or requirement. And to be honest, most people I talk to who are seasoned investors in these banks think that shareholder value would have gone up, not down. Remember, the breakup of Standard Oil in 1911, 1912 was into 35 or 37 companies. Most of them did really well. The shareholders did extremely well. And actually, the Rockefeller family did pretty well out of it, too. The breakup of AT&T in the 1980s, while more controversial and having some side effects, such as making the phone system in some significant ways less robust, also was very good for people who worked in the telecoms industry and very good for technological innovation in this country in and around telecoms.
And over time, could you make the argument that effectively the breakup instantly created value? I mean, do we know enough about the history of those cases to the market immediately recognize? That's a hard question. But
that's a hard question. Right, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, let me ask you this. So who would like to have one oil company with a 90% market share in petroleum products in this country? That's good. Last time I asked the question, one person raised his hand, but he was from the oil sector.
This is a question about taxing banks. Developed countries, Canada, Australia, others, to use taxation to moderate corporate earnings. Could we think about that in the U.S. As an industry-specific measure here?
So it is on the table. It's being discussed at the G20 level. There's two kinds of taxes, actually, that are being discussed. Well, perhaps three. There is a financial transaction tax that I'm not particularly in favor of. I think that gets passed through largely to consumers. I don't think it does much for the problems of power and excessive risk-taking we're talking about. There's a so-called FAT tax, financial activities tax, which is would be levied on banks based on their size, and including presumably as a disincentive to leverage. I think I'm not opposed to that. As you could see that could be consistent with my thinking, but. We also think that'd be quite easy to game, and we fear that it would actually become an incentive to take more risk rather than effectively reducing the risk. And there is also this financial stability levy, I think they're calling it, which is the idea is that you get the banks to pay for the cost of saving them. But that's crazy because the cost of saving them was 40% of GDP. That's the increase. If you just want to look at the fiscal cost, leave out all the other things the Fed did, leave out the fact that you get zero on your saving on your the money you have in banks right now, which is a huge transfer that goes in part to the financial sector. Just look at the fiscal on-balance sheet effect. The increase in net private holdings of government debt, net government debt held by the private sector in this country, will increase, by my estimates, but the CBO's numbers are increasingly similar to this, from about 40% of GDP to close to 80% of GDP. So we'll double our debt to GDP. We'll turn ourselves into something approaching Greece from a debt to GDP point of view because of the measures that had to be taken to prevent that second Great Depression from breaking out. Now, I'm in favor of having taken those measures, given the circumstances, but I would rather prefer we not have to do that again in the foreseeable future. Mm.
A question here that has to do with, I think, that very issue. How do we depoliticize the regulation process, whether it's, just the more general question. And then you introduced the concept of tribes and how we think about how this is playing out in an earlier conversation. Anyways, how do we get better outcomes? This is a very large question. But
Look, I would go back to previous episodes in American history where we've confronted something like this. And to me, the best parallel is with Teddy Roosevelt at the beginning of the 20th century. When he decided to take on the trusts, he took on Northern Securities, which is a massive, egregious railroad trust formed by J.P. Morgan and his colleagues. Nobody knew what Teddy Roosevelt was doing, okay, or why he was doing it. And nobody thought he was going to succeed. That the intuition that I just tested a moment ago by asking you if you would like to have a single company with 90% market share in petroleum products, that intuition didn't exist in the mainstream consensus prior to 1901. Okay, people thought that big was beautiful. There had been a huge wave of industrial mergers coming at the end of the 19th century, which were about improving efficiency and generally making markets less unstable. And in addition to that, nobody thought Roosevelt would win because the Senate was called the Millionaires Club for a reason. Right? These people were an oligarchy. Nelson Aldrich, who was arguably the most powerful senator, Republican senator, Roosevelt's own party, his daughter married John D. Rockefeller's son. Right? This was a small group of people with an enormous amount of power and a very unequal wealth and income distribution, of course. And Roosevelt changed that. Roosevelt, first of all, faced down J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan came to see him in February 1902 at the White House. And J.P. Morgan said, if we've done anything wrong, send your man to see my man and we'll fix it up. And Roosevelt and his attorney general, thank goodness, said, no, we don't want to fix it up. We want to stop it. And from that, and they took Northern Securities to the Supreme Court. They won 5-4. And from that came the antitrust movement, both in broad intellectual terms and in terms of this very specific legal tools that could be used against these big companies. 10 years later, when Roosevelt's successors moved to break up Standard Oil, that wasn't particularly controversial. The consensus had changed. People like you, 100 years ago, had changed your minds, their minds, in that 10-year period. So people understood big wasn't necessarily beautiful. It could also be dangerous to society. And so now we all actually know intuitively, without even taking any economics, that if somebody has a big monopoly, that's bad, that can be, and often is bad for society. So we need to apply that same sort of thinking, we need to have the same sort of change in our intuition within the mainstream consensus, within the parameters of what's regarded reasonable, sensible policy. We need to have that same sort of shift with regard to our biggest banks.
Let me push on that a little bit. As economists, we're both economists, if you said, look, there's free entry into banking, so why don't we see this compete? I mean, you mentioned this implicit subsidy, but isn't that just a recipe for lots of players racing to get the subsidy? I mean, why isn't it more competitive?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's possible that it may become more competitive. My friend who said he wants to become too big to fail, by the way, is not kidding. And the group that he works with is pretty big and very aggressive, and they might be able to pull it off. Of course, we might learn they're too big to fail only under the most unpleasant circumstances. That's, I suppose, part of how they play the game. So I think, though, Rich, a bigger part to your answer is that there are barriers to entry. It's relatively hard to enter that business and to grow to that scale. And some of those barriers are explicit, and some of them are probably somewhat hidden. And the way that they can, of course, work with regulators, and the way that regulation gets crafted, is also with a view to keeping people out. Perhaps we should have a completely free market in banking, but then again, I think that would end up with no regulation at all. But at least the way I see the world, it would end up being just as skewed as it is today. So I understand, and of course, this is part of why we are here and why we've experienced these developments. That banking was not considered, the degree of size and the degree of concentration in banking was not previously considered to violate existing antitrust norms and statutes. And that may still be the case. I'm calling for a change in the consensus and a change in our thinking about what's dangerous and what's acceptable on the part of certain kinds of businesses. And that's what Roosevelt called for also at the beginning of the 20th century. Now, he had some particular legal tools, or the people who followed him developed those tools, actually. When he first called for it, nobody knew what the heck he was talking about. Mm. And I think that the parallel today, to my mind, is quite striking.
So how do if the way we've thought about antitrust is not capturing this phenomenon, I mean, just to continue on that, here's one idea, that this is a business that is so relationship capital driven that I can, of course, enter the banking industry and maybe get it to scale, but sort of it's not a price-driven market. I can't buy market share, and it's hard to build relationship capital and compete against the biggest players. It's a kind of specific factor that, in economic terms, that creates a benefit that's easy to protect. Is this?
It could be. I mean, that's a good story. That makes sense. That's actually consistent with how the bankers see what they do and see their value. So that's a nice way to put it. I think, though, and I would readily admit we're at the beginnings of trying to formalize our understanding of this. And what I observe is these banks have become very big, very powerful. They were about to fail in September, October 2008. They also appeared to credibly threaten, perhaps inadvertently, substantial further damage to the economy in early 2009, and they were saved as is, and now they fight tooth and nail against reform. That's a very dangerous combination. That's not a combination that's good for anybody in this room who's not the CEO of a major bank, and I know what these people look like. I don't think they're here.
Are there examples historically that come to mind for you of policy overreaction? That, you know, people were angry, something got done, some real inefficiencies got created, some problems needed to be addressed. But right, that's one of the worries in some people's mind, is that we're all worked up, we all have a reason to be worked up, but we also have to think about. So any examples of that, or is this a world of undershooting when we think about policy reactions to historical past?
I think it's a very relevant concern. One of my friends introduced me to some of his colleagues recently. He said, "This is Simon Johnson. He's a mad economist." And I said, "Anyone who isn't mad isn't paying attention." And that's my reaction is, Rich, that while populism or, you know, sort of knee-jerk reaction and destroying the productive along with the dangerous and the damaging is a big issue in some countries, and it is something you should fear here also. When I travel around the country talking to people, what I find is mostly sensible, legitimate, well-articulated dissatisfaction. And what I hear mostly is people who want to talk about ideas for doing sensible reform. Now, I would say, and I do say to all my friends in the banking system, and I do have still a few of those too, very few, is that if you don't do reform now, if you don't address these issues in this completely reasonable way that we propose, look, the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, as a practical matter, when you got right down to it, would have forced JP Morgan and Citigroup to break into two. Oh my goodness, the end of the world as they saw it. They threw enormous resources into this fight, okay? Fine, they won. Okay, great. Next time. Next time there's a crisis, next time there's a collapse, next time there's a huge unsavory bailout, the discussion may not be between reasonable reformers and people who rather like the status quo to benefit from it. Next time, that may be genuinely people with pitchforks. Okay, next time, you get the populism, you get the anger, and if you've shown that you can't reform the system, that you can't at all move it to be safer, which is my fear. I mean, the bill is not yet done with this through the Senate, but this is my very real fear of where we'll end up. Then the next time you get the real populace, you get the Latin America. What people talk about, Sebastian Edwards, our colleague, writes about Rudy Dornbusch, who we both was our advisor when we were at MIT, wrote about this populism, this destructive reaction to things that people don't like. Maybe they don't like it. They start out not liking it for good reason, but then it gets excessive. So sure, overreaction can happen. I don't think our book is overreaction. I don't think, if you look at the people who are on board with us, the people who have endorsed us from left, right, and center, it's a very reasonable reform agenda. But if you don't do reform and you have another catastrophe, I don't think you necessarily get the debate is with the reasonable reformers anymore.
Thank you. Very important point. I think we have time for just a couple more questions. Here's one. I think I'll summarize it this way. Should we move our money to smaller banks?
Well, there is a campaign called Move Your Money, and you can go on the website, and they'll tell you where to find smaller banks. I think it is, as a symbolic gesture, it makes a lot of sense. My money is with a small savings bank in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and with a credit union in Washington, D.C. I think those things would only be symbolic. Here's a good application of that, though, which you should consider. Next time somebody runs for election, ask them where they keep their money. Or if they used to be state treasurer, ask them where they kept the state's money when they were treasurer. Right? Move your politician's money is my slogan.
Two more quick ones. Here's one. Isn't the problem gambling with other people's money? This question of sort of agency and do you have enough skin in the game? This is a big question, but
absolutely. But you know, that's the nature of finance, the nature of a modern economy. Let's say we had the kind of world that I like, where people start businesses, they're backed by venture capital. Okay, which is in turn is mostly or entirely equity financed. Okay, so take debt out of that, and I think this would make a lot of sense. Some people argue for what's called narrow banking, and what I just described would be a component of narrow banking. The people who are taking risk are funded by people who are equity backed, and therefore you can have variable returns without people feeling that you know everything has collapsed. In that world, the people who have the venture capital are still using other people's money. And in that world, even though there is more downside, depending on how you structure the incentives for the venture capital people, there's also this asymmetry between upside and downside. And they will take risk because they're using other people's money. You take more risk with other people's money, particularly in a world of limited liability, okay? And it's very hard to see how we'd run the modern economy without some form of limited liability. You'll take more risk with other people's money. Now, the last banker who was executed, I have looked this up, in the Anglo-American system was actually in 1832, a guy, a British banker, called Fauntleroy. I would not suggest we go back to that. I don't think that's a good idea. And in fact, the U.S., you know, one thing the U.S. has always been good at is being relatively, it changed a little bit at the beginning of the Republic, but we've been relatively good and generous to people who fail. And we're relatively good at letting people get back on their feet and start over. I think that's a very important American principle. And for the entrepreneurs I work with, that's extremely, extremely healthy. But that's always going to give you some asymmetry.
Yes.
And the skin in the game point is always going to apply.
Yes, it is. And one last question, and we can be quick. It's a big question. But as you think about what we've learned in this financial industry and in this financial experience that helps us think about ways markets could fail elsewhere, are there sort of bigger lessons here for you than just this industry?
Absolutely. I think we should. I mean, look, I am a former chief economist of the IMF. I'm somewhat prone to seeing problems and worrying about issues. I worked on crises. That's my main economic specialty. I worked on crises for more than 20 years. I would say anything or anyone who becomes too big to fail It doesn't have to be a bank. It could well be industrial enterprise. It could be people who run parts of your infrastructure. In Korea, it was the big business groups, the chaebol, who were not actually banks. They captured banks, but they were industrial exporters. We've seen this in Russia. I would say it's oil and even more natural gas. Mm. So I think concentration of power and the way that can choke broader economic development is something we've been aware of for a long time. But understanding how big, powerful people can become too big to fail and totally distort incentives, creating global distortions, I worry about that a great deal going forward.
Thank you, Simon. We are, unfortunately, out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I would like to thank Simon Johnson for providing us with his thoughts and his insights. I'd also like to thank you, the audience, for your participation. Professor Johnson has agreed to stay a while and sign copies of his book. He'll be here on stage. I encourage all of you to take advantage of the opportunity. Also, to conclude, there are boxed lunches available for everyone. I believe they're to the right over here. Thank you all for coming, and thanks to the World Affairs Council.